Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mindshifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hello, happy Thursday. Today is January 29th, 2015. I'm Michelle Pichet, filling in for Jeannie, and I'm here today with Dr. Tim Hayes. We warmly welcome you to the show, and thank you for choosing to be with us. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. If you'll press 1, that puts you into queue to talk with our host. We encourage you to call in with your comments and questions, which allow you to actively strengthen and deepen your practice. So now let's welcome Tim in the process of learning and experiencing Aramaic forgiveness.
Thank you, Michelle. How are you today?
You're welcome. I'm lovely. I am lovely.
Short and sweet. Well, we are here to hold another intro and practice session, and we're going to intro the idea of the ancient Aramaic process of forgiveness. And as Michael has taken to saying, I am very pleased and appreciative of everyone who chooses to tune into these shows and attend support groups, Mindshifter support groups around the globe, and I appreciate your having the willingness to explore something new, to apply a tool to improve the quality of your life, to make a commitment to improving the quality of your life, because that benefits everyone. As we are all connected in this, and we're all energetic beings, infinitely connected. So I'd like to express appreciation for everyone listening. And to briefly talk about the primary topic of this show, which is the ancient Aramaic process of forgiveness. And we need to be clear that it is not about pardoning anyone. It is not about the fantasy that someone outside of me has done or could ever do anything to hurt me. It's the fantasy that there is something lacking in me, or there is something that someone else or something else has that I need in order to complete myself. And in the ancient Aramaic, where they discuss the process of forgiveness, all of these fallacies were understood, and the truth that we are whole and complete as energetic beings and souls and minds, that we are all connected, this was known. And it was also known that whenever a person experiences something unpleasant, whether it's a physical pain or an uncomfortable emotion, that's an alarm system placed in me by the Creator to let me know that my energies are off the mark, that I have chosen thoughts or beliefs, or I've stored energies in my system that don't belong there. And once that alarm system goes off and I learn to interpret it properly, I realize I have a correction to make inside myself. And the correction is about a false perception. It's not about my true nature. There's never any need to correct my true nature or anything fundamentally true about me. The only thing that's needed for me to correct is the false perception. And in this work, we call those constellations of false perception reality. My reality is different than everybody else's reality on the planet. My reality is strictly internal It's unique to me and is created out of my own thoughts. My reality is the set of images and impressions that my brain shows me, my carbon-based memory, the physical energetic unit in my mind-body energy system, that it shows me when it has received stimulation from the outside world. And that impression, that set of images, that set of perceptions is unique to me. Nobody else sees and feels things exactly the way I do. And what they knew in the ancient Aramaic is that many, many times the internal perception that I hold is erroneous. It's incorrect. And the system that lets me know where I'm incorrect in my perceptions, where I have taken little bits of reality and rearranged them to form something that's not true, is my energy system, my emotions, my physical aches and pains. And every time there's something uncomfortable or unpleasant in my thoughts, my emotions, or my physical experience, the only way out of that is to go into my own energy, my own thought system. The minute I think anyone or anything outside of me has to change in order for me to be happy or for me to feel peaceful, the key to happiness is lost. That's one of my favorite lines from the book, The Mirror Theory. And that wisdom was known in the ancient Aramaic, and that's why the process of forgiveness was developed and presented through our master teacher, Yeshua, as an internal process, a process to go inside myself, to remove what doesn't belong, to restore the focus of my attention to my and my conscious awareness to my true nature as the energy of love, to my true nature as a being in the mind of God, being a part of, being a ray of light from the sun, being of the same substance as the Creator. And my purpose as such is to extend that energy of love with every person in every interaction all through my life. And when I do that, then I get to be reintroduced to and fully experience my true nature as the energy of love, and it just keeps going. It just gets better. It just gets richer because it is an extension of my true nature, and as I extend that true nature, I get to experience what I'm extending, and I receive it back 10 or 100 or 1,000-fold. And there's a glitch in the system. And the glitch is that when this was known thousands of years ago in different cultures, and it was attempts were made to translate that knowledge into other cultures, for instance, the Greek culture from the ancient Aramaic or the Roman culture or the Latin culture, these cultures did not have within them language and mental emotional concepts that could help explain the core process. And so they did the best they could to approximate. And when they went from the ancient Aramaic into the Greek had a concept called pardoning. And in the system of pardoning, everyone acknowledges that someone did something horribly wrong, and they should be punished according to this ordinance or that ordinance of the people. However, being magnanimous, being a better person than the other, I will let that other person off the hook. I will let them go without having to go through the punishment that we all agree they should have because we all agree they did this horrible thing to me. And the problem in the ancient Aramaic system is that they understood no one can do anything bad to me. No one can at any level harm me in any substantial way, in a way that really matters, because my true essence is this energy of being part of the mind of God, and every person that I encounter is either actively extending that love of God or expressing a cry for help. And in a cry for help, there's no harm that can come. And in the extension of love, there's no harm that can come. The Greeks didn't understand that. The Greeks lived in a world where they said, the powers of the gods are outside of us. The power to hurt people comes from outside of us. The power to make corrections is outside of us. So we have to sacrifice our living children to the gods, and we have to make amends to the gods and pray to the gods, and we have to fight the gods, and we have to enlist certain gods to help us fight against other gods. And so in that system of externalizing all the power, it was not possible for them to talk accurately about what Yeshua taught. It was not possible for them to understand that the only significant difference between any people on the planet, one person or another, male or female, young or old, wealthy or poor, the only important difference at any level was the degree to which a person understands that we are all the same. The Greeks couldn't understand that because they placed value on physical things. They placed value on external things above the internal. And so when they went to translate from Yeshua's teachings into the Greeks, even the best, the most well-meaning people would translate into forgiveness equals pardoning. This internal process, we can apply it to this external system we have. And the problem there is it simply can't work that way. The minute I think anyone or anything outside of me needs to change in order for me to be happy, even if I think I need to change for me to be happy, the key to happiness is lost. Absolutely lost. So the tool for removing what does not belong in my system, the tool for returning my awareness to the conscious focus of my true nature is called forgiveness. And Dr. Michael Rice and Jeannie have created this fabulous website where you can go and get free access to a wide range of tools to help you learn about and begin to implement this process of forgiveness. And that website is www.whyagain.org. If you go to that website and you click on the front page, either the red and white bullseye or the link that says Start Here, you can have access to the most recent version of the seven-step worksheet process called, I still call it the Reality Management Worksheet Process. And Chapter 24 of Dr. Rice's book, which helps explain that process in detail, and at least 12 hours of audio files where you can download to your computer or your phone or your iPad and listen at your convenience to hours of instruction on how to apply this tool to your life by listening to how other real people with real problems have applied it to their life and seen real world in the moment results. So that's our work, and we'd be love to support you in answering your questions, hearing about your successes, hearing about your challenges with either the Reality Management Worksheet process or the Mind Shifter tool or the three earliest memories of conflict or the Codependence to Interdependence Worksheet, etc. So the number is 646-200-4169. If you've been listening to any of our earlier shows and you have questions about the comments that came up last week or this week, or especially if you have a question about something that's going to come up next week, please give us a call, press 1, Michelle will know you're on the line, and we'd love to support you. So Michelle, is there anything going on in the chat room, or do we have any callers and anybody with a hand up?
A couple people in the chat room, the Peace is here, and Mark, we're not too much conversation particularly, but Polynesian people listening, and an opportunity is available if you want to call us right now.
Okay, so as Michael likes to say, if you heard this intro or if you were at one of the presentations that Michael's ever done and you had a question, and you would come up to us afterwards and ask. Do that now. Take advantage of this opportunity and let us know.
Well,
just press one and your hand will go up. Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, yeah, no, we've got somebody on the phone here. It's funny. You and this person texted me within 2 minutes of each other today. So let's say hi to our friend Susan Darnell in Carolina.
Hi, Michelle. Hi, Dr. Kim. How are you today?
Hello, Susan.
Awesome.
Michelle
is
lovely,
perfect.
And I'm delightful and charming.
Yes, you are. Absolutely. I agree. And I'm doing the laws of living. We say I agree a lot. Your talk today about the Greeks is absolutely perfect, right on. This morning I had the privilege of having breakfast with a person who posed a question to me, agape, and one other Greek term of love. It was two words they gave me, agape, and I lost the other one. Maybe you know what it is. They wanted to know with the Aramaic what the how that worked out is equivalent. What would be agape in Aramaic, and what would that look like, that type of love? And I was like a deer in the headlights. I'm just sitting there, and I'm going, well, I think it's rotma. So anyway, I was wondering, Dr. Tim, if you knew, if you could clarify.
Well, some people talk about agape love as brotherly love, as a synonym for some of is charity, or this love of God for us as men. And when I was introduced to this in college, it was as a way to separate out the love of a man for a woman, or a woman for a woman in a romantic relationship, or love of a man for a man in a romantic, intimate relationship, from a more detached from the physical sense. So it was more of a way to talk about brotherly love, was a big term back then. It was a love for all of mankind, and a love that talks about self-sacrifice without any requirement for repayment. That's the way they used to talk about it when I was in college. Now, I'm not an Aramaic expert, and so I can't say, is that the same thing as what was intended by rachma? I'm pretty sure it was not the same thing as what was intended by rachma, simply because, as Michael talks about, Aramaic scholars have lost the true meaning for the word rachma, and they're coming at trying to approximate it from different angles. And Michael talks about how he ran into an Aramaic-speaking culture not within the past 10 years, and he was all excited because he thought, wow, now I can get right from the people who still use this language a living definition for the word rachma. And when he asked them about it, he was surprised to hear them say they've lost the meaning of the word rachma. And the closest they come to it is to say that rachma is the most precious gem a person can acquire. So whatever it is, however it would have been spoken of, lived, and acted upon in the ancient Aramaic, we do not have words to tell us exactly what it meant in the ancient Aramaic. The active translations that came from the Kabur's manuscript and people like Dale Allen Hoffman and Michael's work, The Enlightenment, which distills out some of those meanings that the committee of translators arrived at from the ancient Aramaic Kabur's manuscript. That definition that Michael uses in his work is that rachma is a filter in the mind over intentions, which when rachma is set, allows only intentions keyed to love to be used as the building blocks for my goals. And this is really important because I only do any behaviors once I have set a goal in my mind. So if I have rakma set in my mind, one way to talk about it is that it's a filter in my mind over the frontal lobes, over my intentions. And when rakma is set, it only allows intentions keyed to love to be used as the pool that I choose from to set my goals. And that means my behaviors can only be loving. Another way to talk about rakma is it's the keyway, it's the pathway in the mind, which when rakma is set, allows the active presence of the love of God and the energy of creation to be consciously present in my mind. And I've heard Michael talk about it both ways, and I think they're similar. So you can think about rakma as a filter in the mind, and we have a part of our mind which allows us to do intentions, and a part of our mind in the back of the mind that allows us to have perceptions. And over that part of my mind which allows intentions, I can have a filter set to fear, or I can have a filter set to hostility, or I can have a filter set to this thing they call rakma in the ancient Aramaic. And if I have my filter set to rakma, then it only allows me to have intentions in my mind keyed to love. So from that perspective, what we're talking about with rakma is a concept for which there are no words in any language I've ever heard of or in any other spiritual tradition. Now, some say it is similar to aloha or the concept of ho'oponopono or the concept of I breathe you that some of the Native Americans and other traditions have talked about. It's similar in a way to the concept of namaste. Namaste, one of my favorite definitions for namaste comes from Richard Alpert, who later changed his name to Ram Dass. And he wrote of it this way. He defined namaste as this: I honor that place in you of light and love and truth and peace. I honor that place in you where the universe resides. I honor that place in you where when you go to that place in you and I go to that place in me, there is only one of us. Namaste. So that'll give you a sense of, if it takes several sentences to explain that one word or the concept behind that one word to a Western mind, we have that same kind of complexity going here with the word rakma. And there are times when people like Michael say there were 17 different words in the Aramaic language that were translated by the Greeks as the word love. And when a statement like that is made, many people leave. They hear that, they think they hear what was said, and they leave and they say, oh, the Aramaic culture had 17 words for love. They really parsed it out. Just like some people would say, the Greeks had a word for love, eros, and the Greeks had a word for love, agape, and they were different. And the eros was more that passionate love between two individuals, regardless of gender. And that agape love is that personless, all-embracing love, like the love of God for man or the love of man for all of mankind. The point is, when we say the ancient Aramaics had 17 different words, and every one of them was for a concept that the Greeks had no word for. So the Greeks interpreted all of them to mean the same thing, this one word, love. That doesn't mean the Aramaic culture had 17 words for love. It means the Aramaic culture had concepts, had words for concepts that the Greeks couldn't even begin to understand. And they were all distilled down into this blanket interpretation of love. And that's a huge distinction to make. So people who walk away thinking they heard, oh, the Aramaics have 17 different words for love, they've really missed the point. The point of that statement is the ancient Aramaic knew about, experienced, had woven into their language, had in practice and day-to-day living in that culture, concepts for which we have no understanding, much less any word to describe it. So if you think about it this way, the word namaste in the Eastern culture takes a short paragraph to describe from one of our best minds, Richard Alpert, known as Ram Dass. If he has to take a whole paragraph to try and explain what it means to a Western mind in the Western language, then imagine that level of complexity geometrically expanded when we're trying to take a concept like Rachma and make it understandable to a Western mind. And we say something like, Rachma is a word for a filter in the brain over intentions that allows only intentions keyed to love to be used as the building blocks for your goals. Oh, that's nice. What does that mean? It means nothing unless you understand the role of goals in governing behavior. Unless you understand that a person doesn't do any behavior of any kind unless first he or she has set a goal. And that the goal and the quality of the goal determines the quality of the behavior. And two or three steps before that, the quality of the intention, which was floating around in the person's mind before it was elevated to the level of goal, the quality of the intention determines the quality of the goal. The quality of the goal determines the quality of the behavior. The quality of behavior determines the quality of the interaction between that person and their environment. And so we have here a recipe for disaster if people don't understand how the system works. I'll take a breath and ask if we've answered your question at all, Susan.
Okay, I had my phone muted. It's so funny because when you took that breath, I was like, okay, keep going. I'm listening. This is fantastic. I look forward to listening to it over and over again. Thank you, Dr. Kim. Yes, and more. And you can continue if you should like to, or if there's another caller, you know, that's great too. But this is fantastic. I have a greater understanding. I appreciate it.
Well, was the other word that your friend was asking about, was that eros?
Yes. I believe it was.
Okay. So, you know, again, I'm not an expert in Greek, and I'm not an expert in Aramaic, but my memories from way back in college days when we were studying these different philosophies and Eastern cultures and Eastern religions and Eastern meditation traditions was that eros meant more this erotic type of love. And I believe there's another one, philia is another Greek word for love, which has a more less sexual connotation to it, more like friendship. And there was another word, I don't remember what it was, but that was from the Greeks that was there to be applied to the love between a parent and a child. And again,
Tim, what is storg?
Storg or storge or storge?
Yeah,
I don't know how they would pronounce it, but so that's ringing some little tingling bells in the back of my brain from college days. But the point is, in the Greeks, these were all words for different aspects of this thing they called love and affection between people or between God and people. However, the word rachma and the word kubba are not that. They are specifically about energetic filters, spiritual filters, however you want to talk about them, in the brain, in the mind, not the brain, but in the mind that can be set over the frontal lobe of the brain and over the rear lobe of the brain, which literally filter the intentions and perceptions keyed to a specific type of positive, loving, creative energy. And so it isn't about 17 different words for love. It's about if we had Stephen Hawking, one of the world's most prominent theoretical physicists, give a lecture to a kindergarten class, and then we interviewed everybody in the kindergarten class and asked them what was their most important learning from that lecture by Stephen Hawking about wormholes and string theory and black holes, and we had this collection of words from those kindergarten kids, and we said, oh, this is what Stephen was talking about. He was talking about life in a wheelchair, and he was talking about big things versus little things, and he was talking about things in space versus things on the planet. That's a pretty good approximation of how primitive our understanding is of the teachings of the great masters, like Buddha, like Krishna, like Muhammad, like Yeshua. Quite literally, that's a good approximation. So it's an excellent question. Thank you for answering or asking it. I'm talking about it. I'm not really answering it. I'm giving people something to think about because, as I said, I'm not a Greek scholar and I'm not an Aramaic scholar. What I have heard from people who have studied Greek and what I've heard from people who studied the ancient Aramaic, and specifically people who have worked to apply those things practically to their lives, people like Albert LaChance, Michael Rice, Dale Allen Hoffman, leads me to give the kind of answer I just gave, which I hope raises more questions in your mind than it provides answers. Because if you begin to question, wow, what does that mean, a filter in my mind over intentions that when it's keyed to love only allows intentions keyed to love to be used as my goals, then you'll start to explore. Maybe you'll go to the website at yagen.org. Maybe you'll get Michael's book and read it. Maybe you'll check into the book Enlightenment on the Kabouris manuscript. Maybe you'll do your own research. What was known as the Lord's Prayer? What was really meant when Yeshua gave the talk that they're calling the Beatitudes? And read, look into Dale Allen Hoffman's interpretations of that. Look into the Enlightenment manuscript. Michael has frequently put out the challenge to some of us who do this work or go to his classes or seminars to say, why don't you get the Enlightenment book, look in the glossary of definitions, and then make your own translation for the Lord's Prayer. Come up with your own translation of the Beatitudes, using the glossary of the best we think we know about what this particular word meant in the ancient Aramaic, and going to this list of words that's been put down from the ancient Aramaic as the Lord's Prayer or the Beatitudes, and make your own translation and see what you come up with. Because then you're adding your unique insight, your creative mind, your intelligence, your life experience as a filter for this energy which is trying to express through you. And you may bring into existence on the planet a level of understanding that hasn't been here before. This might just be why you're here. This might just be one little piece of why you're here. But I hope this answer doesn't answer anything for you, but it stimulates questions. I barely mentioned Kubba as a filter in the back of my brain over perception. And what does that mean? question that, look for that word in the Enlightenment manuscript or in the talks from Dale Allen Hoffman or in his writings. Look for it in, who's the guy who did all of the, some of the original translations of the Aramaic Bible, whose name is escaping me. It will come to me, but Lamsa and, well, there's a few others, but there's one key person who's done a lot of transcribing, translating from the ancient Aramaic into English of the Hebrew Bible. And
a modern person?
Yeah.
Like Rocco Errico?
Rocco Errico. He's one of the biggies. So go to his work, read his Bible, and then do your own translations. Question it for yourself. If you do, it will be far more worthwhile than listening to Dr. Tim prattle on about what he thinks he knows. Because clearly, now I have told you far more than I know about the words love in Aramaic.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Thank you. And I will ponder it. And I'm sure my friends, when I go back, will have more questions for me to ponder. So thank you so much.
Well,
Tim,
you're very welcome. Is there something else we can support you with today?
No, I'm good. I appreciate you. Thank you for taking the show while Jeannie and Michael are taking a intermission or a pause in their life just to take a rest.
Well, you're quite welcome and deserving. Did you have a support group or a loss of living class this week yet?
I did on Tuesday. We watched Purpose, Personal Power, and Commitment, and we did the worksheet to get this to formulate a secondary purpose. And that's exactly what we'll do this week in week two of Laws of Living. So that was very, I think that's very important. We're looking at doing the goal management worksheet. And when you have that worksheet, it's a little box that you check. Is this goal that I have framed the night before in alignment with my primary and secondary purpose? So it was really great to see people, contemplate their talents, their gifts, their abilities, and what they enjoy doing to create a statement of purpose. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I'm always interested when we show that and I go back and review my secondary purpose and to see how it's evolved over the years and how it gets to be, for me, clearer each time. So I'm glad you're doing that. Thank you for running a support group, and thank you for, as Michael would say, all of the benefits you're giving to your community by holding the space and holding the support group and teaching the laws of living. It's a blessing to know you're there.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I appreciate that. And I want to put out to our listening audience that on Saturday, February the 7th, there'll be a workshop on Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing at the Unity Church. So if anyone's interested, they can call me or email me. And I can give out my number if that would be appropriate, or an email, whatever you prefer.
Whatever you're more comfortable with.
Well, I'll give out my email because someone might be more comfortable with that and might have a easier time to catch up with me. It's Awaken, it's AWAKEN, the letter B as in boy and the letter N as in Nancy, Awaken 2, the letter 2, the number 2, B as in boy and N as in Nancy, @gmail.com. So, again, that's Awaken2B @gmail.com. So, that's it. It's wonderful.
Oh.
I'm excited.
Okay, so did you say it's Awaken2B?
BN.
As the letter B as in boy?
Yeah, I left that out, too, yes.
And then N as in Nancy?
Correct.
So the letter N as in Nancy is there, too.
That's correct, it is. And
okay.
I had the, it's so funny because I had the email, I hope this doesn't confuse anyone, as Awaken to Be at Yahoo for years and years, probably 15, 20 years I had that. And when I got to Michael and Yeshua's work, I realized I had a letter missing. It was awakened to being, my being of love. So anyway, it's all good. And Gmail, I like Gmail too. So I went to Gmail from Yahoo. So it's awakenedtobein@gmail.com.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for the call and the question. And I'll look forward to hearing you the next time you choose to call in.
I appreciate you. Thank you. I love calling in. Okay. Take care. Have a good one. Thanks,
all right,
Michelle.
Bye-bye. So, Michelle, are you there? And do we have anything going on in the chat room or anybody else with their hand up?
Yeah, in the chat room, we've kind of been going back and forth, mirroring some of the conversation that we've been listening to. And Michael has a good way of describing this. I keep thinking about, like, the Tower of Babel and the symbols, but that, you know, just by taking a concept like Rachma and putting it into language, you automatically inherently remove the connection to it, and, you know, being more experiential than the symbol on the paper or the word. And so kind of processing some of that. Do you know what I'm thinking of when he talks about the removal when you put the symbol on it?
You mean if you're trying to make the symbol encompass the whole meaning? Are you talking about how if you form a belief about something, then you make it static and not a living thing for you? Are you talking about that level? Are you talking about the importance of putting a symbol on it?
No, the opposite. That like an existential, like the experience is what provides each individual with the meaning, and that you put it in a box and limit by the, you know, language that you use to describe it. But it becomes, you know, too limiting. I just keep thinking limiting. And, you know, my idea of a word is different than your content for the same word, and then it just binds it somehow.
Exactly. That the concept is, at a deeper level, to say that words have no meaning. The meaning is held within the internal experience and what Michael would call the brain cell impressions of the person who is stimulated by the vibrations that are sent out from someone's vocal cords when they try to speak a word. But the word itself, the vibrations that are sent through the air, the nerve passages that get stimulated in someone's ear, these things have no meaning. The meaning comes inside the mind of the person who is stimulated by that external stimuli. One of the ways I used to talk about it was, let's say we're in an auditorium, and everyone in the auditorium speaks English, and that's their only language. And as the presenter is reaching for a little sip of water, someone comes charging in to the room in Russian, very agitated, speaking, waving his or her hands. And there's a chuckle and there's some laughter, and then the speaker starts speaking again, and the person speaking in Russian is getting more and more agitated and moving around and waving his hands and trying to pull somebody out of their seat. And the audience is laughing. And now, the person in Russian is speaking very, very accurately with perfect pronunciation in the Russian language, saying, "The building's on fire, get out now." And the person is saying those words, which have powerful meaning only to the brain cells of a person who has that meaning loaded up with that set of vibrations. And as soon as somebody types into their phone, in their Google Translator, whatever they think the person's saying in Russian, and they identify the English word fire, and they start saying the word fire, Now, the meaning that's in the brain cells of the people sitting in the auditorium for danger and fire, now that gets activated in them. But the word doesn't carry the meaning. So it doesn't matter how much I talk to you about Rachma and Kuba and the power of this worksheet process, if you don't pick up the tools and explore it for yourself, applying it in your life, feel the difference in your body, in your mind. Every time you get agitated, you make your home in your breath, and you feel what it feels like to you to shift the focus internally. And you feel whatever happens in you when you quit chasing conditions and people outside of you, thinking that they have to change in order for you to be in touch with your true nature as the energy of love. When you do that, you create meaning, you create knowledge, you create acknowledgement and awareness that no words can communicate. You're on, Michelle. What do you have?
So that was what the essence of the. I'm just going to go like this. The essence of the conversation in the chat room was related to those ideas. And Richard's on the phone here with his hand up. So, happy Thursday, Richard.
Happy birthday.
No, Thursday. Happy Thursday.
Oh, happy Thursday! Happy Thursday to you back. How you doing?
Good. What's going on with your concepts of love, or do you have something different?
Well, I, in some ways, sort of like an analogy, you know, I remember reading a book one time, and they, you know, everybody thinks of snow just as snow, S-N-O-W, that four-letter word, that nasty thing that comes in winter. But most people's concept of snow is just that little hexagonal pattern of thing coming down out of the air, an image of what snow is. But in the Alaska, the Eskimos had like 17 different types of snow to talk about. So in some ways, we're talking about the same thing here about love. There's all these different descriptions of love. It's just how, you know, how do we, where are we fitting in with it, I guess, is another way of talking about it. I was working with a friend recently, and we've been working on potential workshop together. We want to start doing this workshop together, which I call formal dance, because we're dance partners, and we want to teach a workshop on weekends called Forgiveness and Movement for Eternal Life. So anyway, that's what how I, it's an acronym for formal. So anyway, we were trying to come up with a tool for the workshop, and I think we've sort of settled on love always wins, or love wins always, something like that. So anyway, that's my comment on love, but I wanted to ask Tim, Dr. Tim, about the newborn state. We have that statement in there in the middle of our worksheet talking about the newborn state. You know, we want, you know, and we really haven't talked about that much on the show that I recall, and I just wanted to make a comment. I mean, we talked about Kundalini energy the other day a little bit, and in the Eastern philosophies, the awakening of Kundalini energy is sort of in the body is sort of like the Christ being, that little Christ being inside of us awakening or awakening to its to that Christ's presence in our body. And anyway, and the other thing I wanted to talk about is you talked about the light in Namaste, and, you know, I tend to, talk about it in the sense that, I do this meditation. It's called the Pyramid Meditation, but in it, you basically imagine eventually, well, there's all these different pyramids starting at your at the lower down chin. And then there's all these different pyramids stacked on each other going all the way out to the universe. And you basically imagine each one having a light shining. And another way to think about it is every cell in your body is radiating light. And so seeing that light in everybody, or honoring that light as our true being, to me, is that newborn state, recognizing that that light within us is the essence of who we are. And coming to recognition of that is the newborn state. That's personal interpretation of the newborn state. You have any feedback on that?
Okay, well, two things. Thank you for the call. I would agree with you about your interpretation of the newborn state. This is something that comes up on a regular basis in our support groups. Some people have the association with a newborn, which is so positive and so loving and so... it's a tangible experience of gentleness and vulnerability and joy and creativity, and that's a wonderful tool for them to get in touch with their true nature. Others have so many associations to that newborn state, either in themselves or their children, that are negative, they either had a traumatic birth or they had difficulty with the birth of one of their children, or they were unable to have children, or they lost a child. And so when Michael says, think of a newborn child, it just resonates in them. Remember, the meaning isn't in the word. The meaning is contained in the energetic impressions in the individual's brain cells. So if the words, think of a newborn state, stimulate fear, anger, resentment, tension, vulnerability that's uncomfortable, then use a different set of words. What we want you to have when we talk about the newborn state in the worksheet process is a tangible experience of the energy of love, consciously you being aware of the energy of love, which is the energy that keeps your heart beating and your food digesting, and for some of us keeps our hair growing. We want you to have a conscious awareness of that physical expression of the energy of love, which most people on the planet have been conditioned away from tuning into. And we are trying with the worksheet process to get people to practice tuning into it. Tune back into it, recognize that it's always there, and especially tap into it whenever you're feeling anything less than loving. And so that meditation you were talking about would be a very good thing if it leaves you with a very positive, energetic, physical, emotional experience. That's what we're going for. And again, it's something that goes beyond words and beyond the meaning of words, and we're only using words to help point people in the direction of practices that they can engage in, which, if they are lucky, will bring them the experience of the truth, capital T, what actually is. The other thing is, I'd like to use your other comment about the different words for the conditions of snow, and I would like to use that with your permission as an example of the opposite of what I was talking about. So here you're illustrating one of the problems of interpretation. When someone says, when the Greeks were trying to interpret the ancient Aramaic, there were 17 different words that stood for separate, different, powerfully different concepts that there was no word for in the Greek culture or language. And because they had no word for it, they approximated, they made guesses, and they clumped them all together as the word love. And to my mind, that's substantially different than having 17 different descriptors for the qualities that express in snow. If it's warm and soft, if it's crystalline and hard, if it's cold, ultra cold and powdery, those different kinds of qualities for this substance, snow, had these different labels, which helped people tease out the different aspects of this energetic expression. So in that way, it might be similar to how the Greeks had a word for love between a man and a woman that's romantic and sexual as eros, and another word for that love or affection between a man and mankind, or God and man, as agape, and another one for the love between classmates in high school, where there is no sexual component, as filial love. And that would be a better analogy. But what we're talking about in the ancient Aramaic is there were concepts for which it's not love, it's not anything like just this thing we talk about, love, I love you, or I extend my true nature of love to you. It's a whole different aspect of experience of life and the functioning of the mind, the soul, and the body interacting that the Greeks had no way to comprehend. And they simply clumped them all together in the one word love as they were doing the translations. And so thank you for letting me use that example and hope to clarify. Again, I think it's a really good way to think about it. If you had the world's most renowned physicist come and talk to a kindergarten class, and that physicist was talking about dark matter, was talking about a parsec as a measurement of distance, and talking about the arc of observation, and talking about how fast light travels, and on and on and on, talking about quarks and talking about string theory and talking about the unified field theory. And then afterwards, you go to these kindergarten kids, these 4- and 5-year-olds, and you get their impressions and you use their words to describe what the physicist said. That's a closer analogy to what happened when the Greeks tried to interpret the Aramaic. If you can just try to wrap your head around that, what could a kindergarten child tell you about an hour-long lecture or a 2-hour lecture from one of the world's greatest physicists? That's pretty much what we got from the Greeks by way of understanding what the master teacher Yeshua had to teach us. And if you listen to the people who are doing the translations directly from the ancient Aramaic into English, you end up with statements over and over again saying, do this, and you'll have this experience. Practice this. Go inside yourself and have this experience. The things I have done, you can do, and greater if you practice this tool. So with that, we're going to have to wrap up the show. I just got the word in my ear that we have less than 90 seconds left. I want to thank you all again for being here. I want to thank you, Michelle, for hosting. I did get a message from you that you're going to try and call me at 4 o'clock your time, which would be 3 o'clock my time. And come back tomorrow, bring a friend, and come back all next week. And in the meantime, do what you can to practice these tools or any other tools that will help you have the best year yet of your eternal life. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.